Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 12th of July. We call ourselves the Ideas Network, and every now and then you read something and you say, well, there's an idea that we ought to talk about on the air. And thus, the first hour of our program today. I don't know if you saw the New York Times, what do they call this section now? It was my week in review, and now it's not. It's the Sunday review of the New York Times, in which professor of law at Temple University Law School, Burton Cain, wrote about the Supreme Court. And it was on the page where there are all these different viewpoints about the Supreme Court and his idea. He asks this question, which is the question of the hour: why not give the president, upon election, the power to appoint an additional justice to the Supreme Court with the consent of the Senate? That would give the people a greater role in choosing them. He writes, Supreme Court exercises vast powers affecting our lives, and he says it's been seen in dramatic cases like Bush v. Gore, Citizens United, the Affordable Care Act was at risk. The Roberts Court, he says, surprised us, but ignoring judicial restraint, ruled that the mandate could not be justified under the Commerce Clause, the basis for important civil rights statutes and other social welfare legislation. Opinion is likely to be cited in efforts to defeat laws on affirmative action, same-sex marriage, and voting rights, and other progressive legislation. So how about this, adding a new member to the court with the consent of the Senate? We'll talk about that and the vast powers the Supreme Court has. Professor Burton Cain wrote the piece, which is well worth reading, in the New York Times on Sunday. He is professor of law at Temple University Law School. I just have a feeling that a lot of you are going to want to comment on this. And our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and you can always send messages on Facebook as well, and that is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Burton Cain, hello. Thank you for being with
us.
Good
morning.
You must have thought somewhere, at least I thought, what a perfect idea for a talk show, too, because it's just a really interesting idea. Let's start with the current Supreme Court and compare it in history to other courts that may have been as activist. It's a conservative court, but we have seen, as you say, dramatic cases from this court. What are those dramatic cases, and are they different in any way from a liberal Supreme Court some years ago, say in the New Deal?
Well, we had very dramatic cases, some good, some bad. Dred Scott was one of the worst cases ever decided, that slaves are not human beings, that they're property. And the people rose up against that. They amended the Constitution, and we have the abolition of slavery and equal rights, allegedly. So that was one terrible decision, but the people corrected that, as the Constitution provides they might. And then we had Plessy versus Ferguson, which said that you can segregate on public facilities, and took a long time before that was overruled in 1954 by the Supreme Court, so that was a good thing to do. But Citizens United, for example, is one of the worst cases we've ever had, because it allows people to buy elections, and all you need is money now, not votes. And that was bad enough, but the Supreme Court made it worse. Most people don't even realize that when the health care case came down, this also came down. And they said that Montana, which had a law for long standing that you can't buy elections, they overruled that case. They didn't even hear it. They wouldn't even allow people to file briefs. They wouldn't even allow people to give argument. They simply did it. And all these current decisions are by 5-4 votes. They're political decisions. You have 5 conservatives and 4 liberals, and that's the way it goes. Courts should not operate that way. That's the way the country may operate, but a court shouldn't operate that way. And it's not even limited to the question of civil rights cases, although there are more civil rights cases. FCC versus Fox TV, for example, recently came down. Here was a decision in which the court said that things you can see on cable and on your computer, you can't see and can't hear on public radio. A decision so terrible that even Clarence Thomas said that ought to be reconsidered, although he never said that recently. He said it a long time ago, I guess. And then we had a case, for example, involving abortion, where Congress passed a law prohibiting a particular type of abortion, and the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 vote, said Congress can do that. That's the only case we've had in the history of the United States which validated banning abortion of any kind. And then we've had cases involving, for example, antitrust, where the court overrules antitrust cases one after another, And one of them was a case of almost 100 years ago involving maximum and minimum price fixing when you sell a product, and the whole nation relied upon that case, and Supreme Court overruled it. Again, it's 5-4, and again, it's the conservatives against the liberals. That's even worse in many respects than the civil rights cases, in the sense that the antitrust laws are not a constitution. They're a statute passed by Congress. Congress can change it any day in the week. And instead of Congress changing it, Supreme Court changed it. Well, you get to a point where you start to wonder whether the court is acting like a court or a bunch of politicians. We have a couple of members of the Supreme Court who act like politicians outside the court, and they issue statements, and they criticize the president.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a judicial system just run amok. And my suggestion, which is the most mild you can possibly imagine, because one way of dealing with this problem is simply to rewrite the whole Constitution or to amend the Constitution. That's a very difficult thing
sure.
to do. Very difficult. Mine is easy, because the Constitution does not provide the number of justices on the Supreme Court, and it has varied from 5 to 15, so it's been changed many times. And all I'm suggesting is when you elect the president, apparently the president can tell you, I'm going to put another justice on the Supreme Court. Therefore, people voting for them have at least an indirect right to participate in the decision. They still have an indirect right now, because every president has the right to replace somebody on the Supreme Court. But this would simply be a very mild solution to tell the Supreme Court, start acting like a court, or we're going to do something pretty drastic.
And that person serves for a lifetime appointment, or just during
the
presidency? Yes.
Serves a lifetime appointment. But, you know, some people say, well, the Supreme Court is going to be too big. Well, it's been up to 15. Congress can always reduce the size or increase the size. They have many times. I mean, they did it in 1801 when John Adams was president of the United States. So I'm not suggesting anything radical. The whole point of looking at the Constitution is to make sure you obey the Constitution. Of course, you're not obeying the Constitution.
Were there other times in the court's history when it was functioning like a legislator, but they were liberal legislators?
Well, you can make that argument, except that the argument runs into a very different preservation of the Constitution. Very few people read how the Constitution begins. And the Constitution begins by telling you that the Constitution is for the purpose of preserving liberty for ourselves and our posterity. So that should infuse every single provision of the Constitution. That's what the court is supposed to do. So if they uphold individual liberty, that's exactly the theme of the Constitution. Therefore, when they do that, it's not the same as when they curb individual liberty, because the Constitution was for the purpose of making sure that our liberties were protected, even against the people. And therefore, if you take some of the liberal decisions, for example, the Supreme Court protecting freedom of speech or protecting rights in criminal cases and so forth, that's exactly what the court was supposed to do, and the Constitution, I think, sends that message. So I don't think you can compare, as some of the readers did in answer to my letter, well, sometimes they do good and sometimes they do bad. But the answer is, if they do good because the Constitution tells them to do good, that's great. If they do bad because the Constitution doesn't, that's terrible.
Mm-hmm. When did you mention the 1803 Marbury versus Madison, the idea originating that the Supreme Court can overrule the elected branches of government? What was that case?
The case was one in which President Jefferson did not want to grant nominations for a local court. Adams, before he left the amendment, before he left, he was defeated. He wanted to be president again, but he lost. So he nominated what's called the Midnight Judges. And therefore, he said, you're a judge, you're a judge, you're a judge, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
His term expired at that point, and some of the commissions had not been given physically to some people, including Marbury. So Marbury brought a lawsuit and said, give me my commission, that piece of paper on your desk, give it to me. And the Supreme Court said Congress had no power to add original jurisdiction cases to the Supreme Court. They weren't hurting the court at all. They were giving it additional power. But John Marshall was a pretty shrewd guy and a very political guy, and he saw an opportunity to enhance the power of the Supreme Court where nobody would object, because Jefferson won the case, so he was delighted. And the Supreme Court never did it again until the Dred Scott case almost 60 years later. And the result is that nobody really took into account the notion that we can tell, Congress can't tell us what to do. Now, that nobody really was concerned about the case until the court started to use that power in modern times to really strike down litigation. I think Marbury versus Madison has been misinterpreted all the time because I don't think it stands for the proposition that everybody cites it for. I don't think it stands for the proposition that the Supreme Court will tell everybody what to do, because at least 99.9% of the decisions the Supreme Court can't deal with at all. The president, for example, vetoes a bill because he says, I think it's unconstitutional. The court can't do anything about that. You have to have an actual case or controversy. So most cases involving constitutionality can never even get to the Supreme Court. Moreover, what I think Marbury versus Madison stands for is a different principle. I think it stands for the principle of separation of powers. But a basic underlying notion of the Constitution is there are three branches of government and one can't overrule the other. The result is don't tell me what to do. If I do something bad, tell the people, because the people can normally either directly or indirectly take action about that. So I think Marbury versus Madison has been wrongly read all these years. And I'm happy to see, for example, in the current edition of the New Yorker magazine, a very prominent professor of history at Harvard said that the decision in Marbury versus Madison, the way it's been interpreted, she uses the word astonishing. I agree with her. I think it's totally wrong. It seems to me that you put three different branches of government and the basic liberty is the liberty of the people, and the basic duty of the court is to protect the liberty of the people.
And what about the Constitution? You talk about the Supreme Court and the power it has over our lives. You say that the Constitution doesn't say that it should have that kind of power and implies the opposite. How does it do that?
Because if you look at the Constitution, Article 1 is Congress. They get a lot of power. You look at Article 2 of the President, the President's power is largely limited to enforcing the law, so he gets less power. If you look at the language given to the Supreme Court, it says, and I'm quoting it, there shall be one supreme, small s, not capital, one supreme, the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in a Supreme Court and any other courts that Congress shall ordain or establish. Nobody had any idea whatsoever from that half a sentence that the Supreme Court would be the ruler of everybody. I mean, it's exactly the opposite.
You mentioned Citizens United, and just a few moments on that before we go to our many phone calls. You should know that our phones lit up before you even started talking. It is remarkable, isn't it, Professor Kane, to see the amount of money. It's really awful, actually, to see the amount of money and people coming out of obscurity, maybe winning races because they're spending a phenomenal amount of money to run, to be elected. I keep thinking, and it's a basic thought, but all this money, couldn't we be using it for something else?
It's worse than that. For the simple reason that we had a lot of laws to stop that. And what the Supreme Court had to do was to overrule a whole bunch of laws. Now, where does it get that power? Even addition to that, they said states can't even do that. Montana had a law which says you can't buy elections. And the Supreme Court, as I mentioned before, by a 5-4 vote, these are 5-4 votes all the time, 5-4 vote says even the states can't enforce their own laws saying you can't buy elections. Now, you know, when you're talking about 5-4 decisions on major constitutional issues, what you really mean to say is by one vote, by some judge who's never been subject to any election, you can't get rid of them, that one vote can overrule all the people of the United States, the President of the United States, the Congress of the United States. That's a pretty drastic system. I don't think it was ever intended to do that. This is supposed to be a democratic country. Democratic country means that the people ultimately are ruling, not people who are not subject to election. And the only reason why we give the Supreme Court such power that having life tenure is because they're supposed to enforce unpopular decisions when it comes to individual liberty. After all these cases that we're talking about in the Supreme Court, cases involving abortion, the cases involving the unpopular ideas, the people are the ones at fault in that case because they get their legislators to pass laws, which they like, and which Oliver Wendell Holmes says is simply incorporating their prejudice. So therefore, you want somebody to be able to protect individual liberty, and that's what the Constitution says. In my view, it says it twice. Once at the beginning of the Constitution, I don't know why people call it preamble. There is no such thing as preamble. The Constitution says you're supposed to protect individual liberty for ourselves and our posterity. And then in the Ninth Amendment, the question was, James Madison was wondering whether you put a Bill of Rights in the Constitution, because he says it's a trap. Bill of Rights will indicate to many people that these are only the rights you have no other, and the women should understand that more than anybody, because the Constitution doesn't protect the right of abortion. As a result, guys like Scalia in the Supreme Court and his friends, they say that women have no rights because not in the Constitution. Madison tried to foresee that problem by putting into the Ninth Amendment, the fact that we have listed certain rights does not mean and should not be construed to mean that there aren't other rights which are retained by the people. Scalia said, well, I understand that, thank you very much, but it doesn't say abortion, doesn't say this, doesn't say that. As a result, they've turned the Constitution, in my view, upside down. The Constitution was supposed to protect individual liberty. And if we have cases which protect individual liberty, people can't say, well, it's unbalanced one way or another. That's why we have a constitution. That's why we had a revolution against Great Britain. That's why we have this government. All the compromises that were made in the Constitution, they were terrible ones, like preserving slavery, hoping that it would be outlawed later on, giving states to senators, even though they don't have enough population to have one representative. These are the types of compromises which are put into the Constitution in order to enable us to have a country, to have a constitution. But we didn't make any other compromises which say that when the people want to, they can buy elections or things like that. That's an atrocity. And all I'm suggesting is not going through the difficult process of amending the Constitution, which takes 2/3 of the Congress and 3/4 of the states, and that's a very difficult thing to do and very dangerous too. All I'm suggesting is that we send a message to the Supreme Court, behave. And very little thing, we're going to add a justice each time, and therefore the justice will go through the hearing process of the Senate, and they're going to ask them questions, and they're not going to tolerate any silly answers they got from the present Chief Justice. His job, he said, was to call balls and strikes. Well, that's absurd. They're not calling balls and strikes when they're allowing you to buy elections. They're allowing you to do all these atrocious things. They're not calling balls and strikes. If so, they're all foul balls. I mean, so, you know, somebody has to take into account what's going on and how the Supreme Court has seized all this power and simply say to them, behave.
Professor Burton Cain is our guest this hour. His piece, which Rhonda has posted on our Facebook page, in case you missed it, in the New York Times Sunday Dialogue, it's really a whole page on a response to his idea that he has just outlined, Rein in the Court, debating whether the Supreme Court has grown too powerful and what we do about that. He's a professor of law at Temple University Law School. We go to your phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655 is our number. You can also send an email message. That's open to you now, talk@WPR.org, or leave messages on the Facebook page. I'm sure the professor would like to see some of your responses. We'll ask him to read it when the show is over on our Facebook page, and that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today. This Saturday would have been Woody Guthrie's 100th birthday, and there are celebrations going on all over America this year and also internationally. The author of This Land Is Your Land, Robert Santilli, Woody Guthrie, Journey of an American Folk Song. Robert is also coordinating a lot of those celebrations, commemorations all over the world during 2012. All right, phone calls now for Professor Burton Cain. We start with Adam in Milwaukee. Hi, Adam.
Good morning. I would call myself a conservative politically, I really do agree with the general tenor of the statements being made by the good professor. Personally, I would mainly favor a limitation of the terms for the justices of the Supreme Court. I don't know, maybe 6 years or 10 years, or maybe a term that would start, let's say, halfway through a presidential administration and then end halfway through the presidential administration of a different president, you know, to minimize presidential interference. But some sort of definite term, a time certain, after which they would be required to step down. Because for one thing, there's no accounting for senility, you know, if they're appointed for life.
Professor Kane.
Yeah, my response to that is that if we were to amend the Constitution and start all over again, we would have a very different Constitution. Many of the ideas that I've heard of limiting terms and limiting age and all things like that are all possibilities, and you can find precedents for that in other countries. In Israel, for example, the Supreme Court has to step down at the age of 68, and therefore they have new blood coming in all the time, and people battle whether that's right or wrong. There are also propositions like, why can't Congress overrule the Supreme Court by a superior vote? Or there are other propositions that whenever you depart from a precedent, it has to be 9-0 or a supermajority. All these are wonderful ideas. And if we started the country all over again, they would all be back and talking about. And some of them were talked about at the beginning of our country. Not many, because the court wasn't that significant. Nobody thought the court would do anything more than simply have, you know, talk about little disputes. But that's a very complicated process, and I would love to engage in that. But it takes more time than we have now. The beauty of my idea, if there is any beauty to it, is we can do it now. That is, what I'm suggesting is possible in the Constitution. More than that, it has been done many times. First in 1801. I mean, they changed the number of justices. But all of these suggestions about change require constitutional amendments, which are very difficult, very time-consuming, and very dangerous. Very dangerous when the idea they may amend the whole Constitution, including taking out the First Amendment. I don't know how many people today still believe in the separation of church and state. The religious groups are very powerful. I'm not sure they're going to let that one go through anymore. And the question of freedom of speech, and we're constantly talking about you can't say this, you can't say that. The Fox TV case, which has been in the Supreme Court now twice and will go up a third time, is whether or not you can see the rear end of a woman on New York, NYU Blue and so forth, when you can see it on every place else, you can see it on the beach and so forth. So therefore, we can make all these drastic changes and all these ideas ought to be considered. But they require a constitutional amendment. My idea does not.
What does your idea require? How would it happen?
All it requires is Congress says we increase the size of the Supreme Court. So every time a new president is elected or reelected, he is entitled to nominate one additional justice, and we will approve that justice, and therefore the Supreme Court will be included, will go up. But, of course, they can always make it go down, as they have. The number has varied from 5 to 15 during the history of the United States. I mean, many people are very sentimental about it. One of the letter writers said, well, 9 is a number because that's been that way for a long time. But it doesn't. The Constitution doesn't go that way. American history doesn't go that way. The idea of not putting those types of restrictions in the Constitution indicates that we have the right to make changes.
Let's go to Dave in Wanakee. Hi, Dave.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Dave.
Oh, hi. I wanted to point out that no matter what we do with the Supreme Court, it doesn't matter if the individuals of the court act with impunity. If you look at Clarence Thomas, he is arguably the worst Supreme Court justice in our history. He chose to rule on the Affordable Health Care Act, although his wife is paid by one of the litigants who brought the court to trial or case to court. So I think no matter what we do, if there are no remedies to having a wrong-headed Supreme Court justice, say a Justice Taney, then we're doomed.
I disagree. I think that there is a way of sending a message to him. I mean, he's done worse things than you have mentioned. For example, he didn't report the taxable income of his wife, which is required by law, and she's a politician, and he's a politician, and she made a tremendous amount of money, and he said, I didn't understand the tax law. I mean, he's been, yes, the most outrageous Supreme Court justice we've had during my lifetime, at least. So the result is we can't do anything about it because any time anybody tries to rein them in, they cite Marbury versus Madison. You can't tell us what to do. And all I'm trying to do is give them a little hint that something more drastic is in the offing if they don't behave. Now, we have two members of the Supreme Court are really politicians. It's Scalia and Thomas. They go around giving speeches. In a recent opinion, for example, Scalia said President of the United States shouldn't be doing things like that. He's not a politician. He's supposed to be a judge. And generally speaking, judges have behaved pretty well, whether you like their decisions or don't like their decisions. Today is something totally new in American history, as far as I'm concerned. I would like to curb them in. I would like to limit their terms. I would like to do a lot of things. I would like them to have to pay to make sure that they do things correctly. But it's too difficult, and we need something immediate. The result is I'm trying to do something which is possible and hoping that they will get the message.
Thank you, Dave, for the call. Email from John from Appleton. The power of the justices should depend on the quality of their opinions, not that they were appointed relatively young for life terms that last decades. What about staggered 9-year terms with no chance of reappointment?
All of these things are possible for discussion, but you can't do it without amending the Constitution. That is such a complicated and dangerous process that it seems to me you might get lost in the shuffle. But I agree that we will decide all these things because there are models in other parts of the world. Term limits, age retirements, superior votes, all these ideas have been tried in other parts of the world and tried in some local courts as well. Our Constitution, if you read Marbury versus Madison, the way the Supreme Court reads it, says you can't tell us what to do. My argument is we can tell them, at least there'll be another justice, and when he gets up before the Senate, they're going to ask him, what are you going to do as a justice on the Supreme Court? And if the guy says, I'm not going to tell you, okay, you're disqualified, get somebody else. And don't start talking about calling balls and strikes, as I mentioned a minute ago. That's utter nonsense, and more than that, it simply hides the fact I'll do whatever I want, it's none of your business. So what I'm trying to simply say is that I'm not asking for some drastic remedy which would require simply starting all over again with the Constitution of the United States. If you do that, all these ideas are great ideas and they ought to be discussed. They have pluses, they have minuses, and so forth. But we can't do that under the present setup, but we can do what I am suggesting.
What were the reasons, Professor Keene, for adding more people to the court when that happened? How did it get up to 15 at one time?
In many cases, Congress didn't like the Supreme Court ideas. And the original one was really terrible. I mean, what happened was when Adams was president of the United States, the second president, he wanted to run for re-election, but he lost. The result is in the last few days of his term, he wanted to do something against Jefferson, whom he was bitter enemies. Later, they were great friends, but they were bitter enemies at that time. So he got Congress to say, reduce the number of Supreme Court justices from six to five, so that if Jefferson really wants to change the character of the court, which is then pretty much a federalist court, he would have to get rid of two justices. He would have to have two appointments in order to do that. So these are political fooling around with the Supreme Court, but it's happened. Now, we don't like to talk about all of them because we think the Supreme Court is sacred.
Right.
But it isn't sacred. It's part of our democracy. Democracy is a very lively process. People argue one way or the other. And as a result, the Constitution gave people very limited rights, but they did give them rights. I think Marbury versus Madison, first of all, ought to be totally overruled. I remember once in a meeting that I attended in Washington years and years ago, I sat next to Justice Scalia. We were talking about the decision on the Supreme Court long before the cases that are rising here. And I mentioned Marbury versus Madison. He said to me, you know, it's a decision of the Supreme Court, but, you know, we can change it.
Really? He said that?
Yeah. We can change it. I mean, look, if they changed the law when it came to antitrust after a century, They changed the law having to do with buying elections after several decisions they had to overrule. If they changed the law about it, they can change it too. Now, that's good in the sense that if something is bad, you want them to change it to make it good, like segregation. On the other hand, it could be bad. So there's no guarantee that any decisions will be all to my liking or all to your liking. But there ought to be a guarantee that the Supreme Court sort of acts like a court, not acts like a bunch of politicians. I mean, if you have 5-4 votes, and we know all the time, I teach constitutional law, and I said to my students, I'm going to give you a hypothetical. Can you predict what the Supreme Court will do? And they say, sure. So I said, then why is it a court? I mean, if you can predict what it's going to be and tell me who's going to vote which way, okay. I said, that's not a court. You don't need that.
Welcome. More phone calls. A couple lines are open. We've been busy. 800-486-8655. Professor Burton Cain is our guest, professor of law at Temple University Law School. He wrote a piece, and we put it on our Facebook page, which is, will really get your mind going, Sunday Dialogue. It was in the New York Times. Rein in the court, debating whether or not the Supreme Court has grown too powerful. And he also suggests in the article that we should have 10 justices, give the president, once the president is elected, the power to appoint an additional justice with the consent of the Senate. And this is something you wouldn't need a constitutional amendment. The Senate and the House could say, let's do this. We've had anywhere from 5 to 15 members of the court. Why not rein in some of the power by doing this? What do you think? 800-486-8655. Scott in Appleton. Hi.
Good morning. I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, but I truly think this is ridiculous. I mean, on so many different levels. Here's the truth. If something were like this were passed, and you had a Republican president, and he had a couple of terms in there, people would be moaning the fact and saying, we need to eliminate, we need to repeal this law. There's no doubt about it. The other thing is that really kind of irritates me is when Scalia and Thomas and Alito and Roberts vote together, I'm just going to throw Kennedy out. It is the worst thing in the world. When the four liberals vote together, it's fine. If there were one more liberal on the court and there were 5-4 decisions the other way, we're not having this conversation. And that's the truth. You constantly hear people bemoaning the fact and in the press and everybody about the conservative court. Nobody would complain. I mean, before the Affordable Care Act was upheld, the court was a pariah. You couldn't believe and somebody did a report on how many negative articles there were about the Supreme Court. But then after it was upheld this is the greatest court in the world. This is outstanding. I mean, Roberts is growing. He's just such an impressive individual. Your guest is coming from a very political position. You talk about Thomas and Scalia being political. How about John Paul Stevens, who said, I'm going to kind of hang on here until a Democrat is elected. He didn't want to retire until a Democrat was elected president. I mean, that's extremely political.
Thank you, Scott, for the call. Professor Cain.
Well, of course, the court is political in the sense that it's supposed to reflect the views of the people, take them into account, accept them, reject them under the Constitution. There's no doubt about the fact that the court is supposed to consider very difficult issues in which people disagree. All I'm saying is you can't compare conservative decisions as against liberal decisions because the Constitution of the United States is written in a way to favor liberal decisions. It starts off, we the people of the United States, and it tells you, for example, that you're supposed to, and so I'm reading it to you, secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. These all this, it tells you at the beginning what the Constitution is supposed to do. And if you look at the Ninth Amendment, you see, originally there wasn't supposed to be any Bill of Rights at all. The original Constitution had no Bill of Rights. And some people were outraged. They say, why can't you have a Bill of Rights? My God, that's what the whole Constitution is supposed to do. And the answer by Alexander Hamilton and James Madison was, it contradicts the whole theory of the Constitution because we never gave the federal government the power to invade people's individual liberty. By listing certain rights, you assume that other rights they can do. Madison tried to remedy that defect by putting in the Ninth Amendment that the fact that we're listing certain rights shall not be construed to mean that there aren't other rights of the people. But that didn't work. And it didn't work in the abortion cases. There are four justices on the Supreme Court who think that women are not entitled to have an abortion. Justices on the Supreme Court who think that people are not allowed to have even a contraception. I mean, I'm not making up these cases. I don't have the fertility of imagination to make up all the evil that people can do. And as a result, you have to look at this and see what the court has done in that regard. So I can't compare good decisions with bad decisions and say they're equal. I'm looking at good decisions, in my view, which carry out the spirit of, and the language of the Constitution, the history of the United States, to say that the theme is individual liberty. Sometimes the enemy of individual liberty is a president because he's one person and he could be a dictator, and they try to take care of that. But the other enemy, the people, is the people who pass bad laws. I mean, I can't make up what they did in Connecticut. Connecticut said married couples are not allowed to use contraception. Well, that's so absurd that how could anybody possibly understand that? Well, they did. I mean, they didn't make it up. They did. And therefore, we expect the Supreme Court to follow the Constitution by saying that they are interrupting and they are rejecting the liberty of the people, and therefore they can reverse that. So therefore, I can't compare good and bad decisions as if they're both equally accessible. So therefore, all I'm trying to do is to try to get some notion into the Supreme Court they ought to follow the Constitution.
So what you're asking for, really, is for justices to act more like justices rather than politicians. Is there a way to do that? I mean, that makes sense. Most people would agree with that. Be a justice. You can't be a politician.
There's no way to guarantee that people will behave the way they're supposed to. I don't care whether it's a senator or a president or a mayor or a Supreme Court justice. The best thing we have in the Supreme Court is we have a good tradition. And the tradition is to favor individual liberty even when it was unpopular. As a result, for example, we abolished slavery. People had fought a war over that, but we abolished slavery. We gave equal rights to women. I mean, you have to understand, at the beginning of the country, women couldn't vote. Women couldn't do anything. It wasn't until 1920 that we amended the Constitution to say that women could vote. And look, and when I was at Harvard Law School, my class was all men. Why? Because women were not permitted. Because we were taught by the greatest minds in the world that women simply didn't have the power. Why waste a seat on a woman when you can give it to a man?
Right.
Now the president of the university, the dean of law school, all women. I mean, you know, wisdom changes. But the idea is that you're supposed to do good. If those changes are good, that's what the Constitution provides.
Scott, thanks for the call. Bill in Madison, hi.
Hi. I'm not a constitutional scholar, obviously, but my feeling has been for a long time that the United States' major problems has been twofold. Mainly, the one branch of government, the Congress, has been lazy and ineffective in preventing the other branch, another branch of Congress, the executive, from usurping power. For example, George Bush and his use of signing statements to essentially rule by decree. I mean, he's not the first one to do that, but he was the one who really perfected it to a fine art. We have presidents with war making powers that are way beyond what the Constitution actually says, and we have a Congress that's stood by and watched it happen.
So you're more concerned, Bill, with the power of the presidency than the power of the Supreme Court?
Beg your pardon?
You're more concerned with the power of the presidency than the power of the Supreme Court?
Right. We are. We do seem to have an imperial presidency and not a rubber stamp, but a essentially ceremonial legislature.
Okay, Professor Kane?
Your comment is the wisest of any I've heard so far, not because of what you said, but because of what you implied. You see, what you're telling me is that people are not following the Constitution. When they wrote the Constitution, they understood that a president could be bad, could be a dictator. So they made him Article II. He's under the law. He's not over the law. And it doesn't make a difference whether he does good or bad things. He has very limited power, and therefore the Constitution says that. But what you're also saying at the same time is if we rely upon the court to tell us what is good and what is bad. Our elected officials don't have to perform. What they do, and Arlen Specter is a beautiful illustration of it. I told him that. I know Arlen Specter. When Congress is passing all these terrible laws, he stood up in the Senate and he said, these laws are unconstitutional, but I'm going to vote for it anyway because I went to court to declare it unconstitutional. I wrote him a letter and I said, you can be impeached. You took an oath to support the Constitution. If you think it's unconstitutional, you must vote against it. But no, what they want to do is they want to hide behind the Supreme Court. So when they go for election, they say, well, we didn't do it. The court did it. You can't vote them out. So what you were indicating is that the scheme of the Constitution is people have to perform. They have to face the electorate. They have to do good things. They can't blame it all on the Supreme Court. And, you know, many people blame it on the Supreme Court by using words like politician and so forth, some of the language I use. But if you're doing it for the purpose of saying, elect me because I didn't do this, then the whole system is rotten.
Professor Burton Kane, professor of law at Temple University Law School, is our guest this hour, and we're talking about the Supreme Court having too much power and whether or not the addition of another justice who would be appointed by the president when he or she becomes president would rein in the power of the court. He teaches courses in constitutional law, First Amendment, political and civil rights, and antitrust. And we're welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page where you can read his piece that was in the New York Times on Sunday is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two, Woody Guthrie. Keith in Appleton, hi. Keith, are you there?
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Good morning, Kathleen and Professor Kane. I really applaud Professor Kane's ideas, but you have to respectfully agree, would you not, that all of these ideas may be moot until the insidious rule of the U.S. Senate of the secret hold is eliminated. For example, as far as I know, there are over 20 judgeships in the Obama administration since 2009 that have not been filled because of the ability of one unidentifiable person in the Senate to place a secret hold on the nomination process for any judgeship. How do you overcome this?
Well, I agree there's evil in other parts of the country. I'm not giving you a solution for the whole nation. I'm simply trying to deal with one little problem, and there's no doubt about the fact that the Senate filibuster rule is terrible. And it ought to be unconstitutional. Somebody ought to challenge it, and it ought to be challenged at the polls. I mean, there are a lot of bad things in the government. All I'm trying to do is make a very modest suggestion to send a message to some of the worst decisions made by the Supreme Court that these people have to obey the law. I mean, when they overrule all the precedent and say people can buy elections, look what's happening today. I mean, it's more important how much money you have, not how many votes you have.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't allow a system like that to proceed. That's so basically destructive democracy that somebody has to stand up and protest. Now, are there other evils? Absolutely. Should people stand up and holler? Absolutely. Should people try to curb the senators? Absolutely. When you go to the polls, you do all that. You write letters. You march. You do all the things that democracy demands you do. The most famous quotation in my vocabulary is from Justice Brandeis, who says, the greatest potential evil to government is an inert people. That is, people who do nothing, people who are responsible, people who stand by and watch and let this be destroyed, this wonderful government of ours be destroyed. They're the people who are terrible. And you're pointing out simply another evil. I mean, I'm not God. I'm simply one person who reads the language of the Constitution. I start with the first sentence. I mean, is anything wrong with that?
Yeah, inert people. Oh, we have to work against that. And just because this is front and center and it's consumed so much of the news and our emotional lives the last few weeks. You talk about, in your piece, you look at the Affordable Health Care Act and say that Roberts surprised us, but that the mandate that could not be justified under the Commerce Clause, which is the basis for important civil rights statutes and other social welfare legislation, will be used, probably will be used, in dealing with some other very significant cases. Can you elaborate on that a bit, please?
Absolutely. The Civil Rights Act of 1964, for example, which we look upon virtually as a constitution, because of what it says is private people cannot discriminate based on race. Now, that's part of our law for the simple reason that Congress enacted that. What gave Congress the power to do that? The Commerce Clause, which says they can regulate interstate commerce. Was that challenged in the Supreme Court? Absolutely. Everything's been challenged because Congress does not have any general right to make whatever laws they want to. They have to point to a specific provision in the Constitution that allows them to do it. The two most important are, one is the Commerce Clause, because that's where we have all of our civil rights legislation. That's where all the cases are going to come up now, the case involving voter ID, which is going to come up to the Supreme Court, and about all other aspects of voting. And the only power Congress can point to is the Commerce Clause. By saying, and what the Chief Justice did was utterly out of bounds, because what the judge is supposed to do is take only those portions of the Constitution which will help them validate a law. So they did. They said it under the spending clause. Okay, shut up. That's the end, period. He went out of his way, and I think to please the conservatives on the court and in the nation, by saying, I'm giving you a time bomb. This will destroy all civil rights legislation in the future and in the past. Hmm. I mean, people can now come up and say, I can discriminate on the grounds of race because that law is unconstitutional because it's passed under the Commerce Clause. So by going out of his way, the Chief Justice did that. He not only gave a sop to the conservatives, he gave them the idea of how they can now counter all this liberal legislation. Hmm. So this is a terrible thing for him to do.
But he saved health care.
But he saves health care. But he saves health care on the ground that it's a tax, which is pretty unusual. Okay, fine. Should have stopped there.
Scott in La Crosse, hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
I know time's kind of short. I'll try to make it this as succinct as I can, which for me is always difficult.
It's all right, Scott.
But what I wanted to ask about is, when I studied history, I remember being told at the time, or reading at the time, that the court packing scheme, as they called it, when FDR was up against a very difficult to deal with, in his opinion, Supreme Court, was viewed as this terrible black mark, that he'd really gone too far, that he got all kinds of negative reaction about it. But then just recently, I was hearing a discussion where it said that when he proposed this, what he really did was fired such a shot across the bow of the currents of the Supreme Court of that era, that they really did back off and let a lot of his programs go through, which says to me that, in fact, it was really successful. So I guess from a historical perspective, what I'd like to find out from you, Professor, is what was it? Was it an overreach, or was it really good politics at the time?
Thank you, Scott.
People have summarized your whole argument in one sentence. A switch in time saves nine. And what you said is exactly right, and it's really motivates me. That is, my scheme may not work, but it may tell the Supreme Court, you better behave. FDR didn't work because people were very sentimental about the idea there are nine justices on the Supreme Court, without realizing that that's not in the Constitution. But what it did do was exactly what you said. It told these very conservative justices to stop invalidating New Deal legislation, and they did.
And thank you for the call. Let's go. We have time for one more call. Bill in Wausau. Hi. Oh, no. Wait a second. I got the wrong line. Bill. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I'm glad I was able to get on. I just have a real quick question, and that is, I'm really in favor, Professor, of your idea to add more people to the court so that we might get fairer decisions. But how do you take the politics out of the appointment?
You can't. You're never supposed to. The Constitution doesn't say take the politics out. because after all, the people do have a right to elect the president who nominates, and they have a right to elect the senators who are the ones who approve. So there's no idea of taking politics out. The question is to try to get people to respond to a higher ideal. And then let's not forget this. There have been some wonderful Supreme Court justices. You know the names, Earl Warren, Brennan, Souter. They're all Republicans. They were appointed by Republican presidents. When they asked Eisenhower after his presidency was over, did he make any mistakes when he was president? He said two, and they're both on the Supreme Court.
Thanks for the call. Thanks for all the calls. Well, you got everybody thinking, Professor Cain, we'd all like to be in your class as often as possible.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for being with us. Professor Burton Cain, professor of law at Temple University Law School, where he teaches, among other topics, constitutional law. His very provocative piece is in the Sunday Review section of the New York Times this past Sunday. Rhonda has put this on our Facebook page on the Kathleen Dunn Show, so you can read it. And please put your comments there as well, and we'll pass them along to him, because it's a good topic. It's being a part of a democracy in the best possible sense. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We'll be back after the news.